You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we are joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern.
Kia ora.
What has science got for us today?
A little bit of a medical theme today with some volcanoes added in.
A great mix.
So first off, we're going to talk about the pancreas and pancreatic cancer. So most of us probably know the word pancreas, but we might not know what it does, right? And so it's part of the digestive system. It's basically where the digestive juices or the enzymes that are produced that help break down our food when we eat it, and also it produces insulin, which controls the levels of sugar in our blood. And it can obviously become cancerous. So there's a couple of types of cancer. There's pancreatic adenocarcinoma, which is what people mostly get, and this is when the cells that produce those food enzymes become cancerous. And the other one's neuroendocrine, or pancreatic neuroendocrine, which is when the cells that are producing insulin become cancerous. But what's really devastating about pancreatic cancer is that it means you're going to die. And the overall 5-year survival rate is just 12%. So this means that if 1,000 people get diagnosed, 12% of those are going to be dead within 5 years. And this is largely because we don't see it until it's too late. It's spread. And so what this study was all about was using AI and CT scans to kind of change this. And so they've developed this AI model called REDMOD, which is radiomics-based early detection. And so with any AI, you've got to train it. So you need a data set to train on. And so they were able to collect together 936 CT scans. Most of these came from healthy people. So there was 813 control samples. But then what's really cool is that they were able to get 156 CT scans from people pre-diagnosis. So these people went on to develop pancreatic cancer in the next between 3 months and 3 years time. So they were getting CT scans probably for other reasons. So these aren't easy data sets to collect together. And what they were using these CT scans, they weren't looking for tumors. They were looking for changes in the tissue texture or the structure that are often too subtle for our human eye to see, because we see the tumor in this case, it's maybe too late, or sometimes they can be cut out. But really they were looking for this very, very early on diagnosis, because when you get cancer, often what's happened is that your normal cells have actually acquired some DNA mutation that affects how they grow and divide, and this is where you get these tumors develop and your cancer. So they developed their model, and then with all AI, it really comes down to the testing that tells you how good it's working. So you have a new data set. And so they had CT scans from 63 people that went on to get pancreatic cancer, so the same conditions as what was used in the training set. And this AI actually identified 73% of those people as going on to develop the cancer, which is actually pretty good. That's 3 out of 4. They had compared this to 2 specialist radiographers, and their hit rate was about 40%. So the AI was doing significantly better. And we also should keep in mind that these CTs that they were looking at, just radiographers had looked at these and said, they had never seen signs of pancreatic cancer. They looked fine in that regard. They weren't looking for it necessarily, but there was nothing obvious there. So it really does show kind of this AI has quite some value in this space. Now, they did also test it on 430 healthy people, because, is the AI just telling us everyone has pancreatic cancer? That's not so useful, something. Right? And what they had in this case is of those 430, it did actually say 81 of these people might develop pancreatic cancer. But you can also go and do other testing, right? So it's not that this is the only test. So it's sometimes better to be a little bit overzealous in identifying, potentially developing it, test it some other way.
Like a flagging.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. So, and they went on to test it on a couple of other data sets that they got from other hospitals using different equipment, just to show that it wasn't unique to their set of CT scans, and it had similar levels of performance. So it's kind of, there's obviously, they need to add data to make it a more diverse population, because it was within the US, these studies. But you know, like you can imagine if you're at a high risk of potentially developing pancreatic cancer due to risk factors or family history and stuff, you know, there's a way that, you know, you can now or potentially in the future have these CTs done and they check.
Yeah, and well, I mean, you know, it's usually good to catch cancer early, so that's exciting.
Yeah, no, and particularly like this is the one, pancreatic cancer is the one where you know as soon as someone says I've been diagnosed with it, you're like, oh no, you're like, it's you very often very short time spans that you're talking about. So it is really cool.
Awesome. What else? What's next in the world of science?
The next is the story of baby Cassian, who was born in August last year. And this is, I had never realised that they did surgery on fetuses. And so when I saw the story, I was kind of blown away. And so baby Cassian, in the second trimester of his mother's pregnancy with him, there was an ultrasound done. And what they noticed was his lungs were overinflated and they were compressing on his heart. And this is a sign of a condition called congenital high airway obstruction syndrome. It has the abbreviation CHAOS. And it basically happens when a fetus is developing, the lungs have these secretions that they'll travel up the windpipe and then we swallow them, get rid of them kind of thing. And this is a just part of development. But what can happen in some babies is the windpipe has a blockage, so then these secretions can't get out. They basically swell the lungs, it compresses the heart, and it's just bad. It happens in about one in every 50,000 pregnancies, so not super common. And because it's kind of infrequent, there's no sort of standard single method of care. So it's very much dependent on where the baby's at, where the mum's at, as to what they do. But if you don't treat it, it is fatal. And so often what the doctors will do is they'll try and wait to see, or they hopefully the mum and bub can make it to 37 to 39 weeks, so pregnancy is 40 weeks long, and they do this variant of cesarean section. So they half deliver the baby first. So they'll deliver the head, neck and shoulders, but they keep the lower half in the womb. And what this means is that the baby's not breathing necessarily itself yet, it's still getting nutrients and stuff from mum, and then they can insert a catheter to bypass this blockage. So a catheter just being a tube, they can drain out the fluid, the baby can then breathe, and they can then clamp the umbilical cord and deliver the baby like normal. Now this is called an ex utero intrapartum treatment, abbreviated to EXIT, which I thought was really appropriate. But only like 3 out of 4 of these babies will actually reach these final weeks of pregnancy. 1 in 4 will not and pass away. And that's what was going to happen probably in Cassian's case, where his heart was just being compressed too much. It wasn't going to grow and it was going to lead to development problems. And obviously his parents really did not want this. And so they basically said to the medical team, is there anything you can do? We're willing to take the risk. And if you can learn anything from this, even better. So the medical team came up with a somewhat extreme in some ways idea where they were going to do this exit procedure, but instead of delivering baby Cassian, they were going to put him back in the womb to leave him there to keep cooking it, ostensibly. So at 25 weeks, they basically half-delivered Cassian, so they again exposing the head and neck, put this catheter into the windpipe, down into the windpipe, drain those lung secretions, but then they actually left the catheter there using a balloon to keep it in place, and then put Cassian back in the wound, sewed everything up, and mum continued on till 31 weeks when Cassian was had to be delivered, because this was major surgery, so often you don't get a full length pregnancy. But what makes this so, that's kind of amazing anyway that you can do this. But it's also when you consider the risks involved, it's pretty extreme. Like, you need to obviously keep mum and baby going. And so what they did was they used general anaesthesia, so completely knocked out both. Whereas usually in a cesarean section, it's regional, so like the lower half gets numbed, but mum's still awake. They had to do this. Basically, the first thing was they couldn't have the baby try breathe, because when you're in utero, you're getting oxygen from the placenta. So there's this blood vessel, basically, that brings in oxygenated blood. It bypasses the lungs because your lungs aren't developed yet, so you can't oxygenate that blood yourself. And that's how you get oxygenated blood around your body. Now, as soon as that fetus tries to breathe, that blood vessel starts closing up. Like, it's the signal to the body, like, things are changing. So they really needed this baby not to breathe because they wanted to put it back into the womb to continue development. So that's why that was general anesthesia for the baby, but we don't really know what that does at 25 weeks, so they're going to have to monitor this kid for a while to see if there's any effects long term. And then with the mum, Kashira, who, when the uterine wall muscles are cut, their natural instinct is to contract. Now you contract to get rid of, to like eject the baby, basically, which is, again, we didn't want happening. So they used a general anesthetic to completely numb everything, so that wouldn't happen. And also, when that contraction happens, it's a lot of blood loss. So they didn't want that either, because they were wanting her to remain obviously as healthy as possible with all her blood, so that the baby could continue to develop in utero. And then the final thing was, they used this balloon catheter and they left it in there, but they had to get the inflation exactly right, because if they underinflated, it would slip down and then put pressure on the windpipe. If it overinflated, it could compress nerve blood vessels so that they weren't getting drainage out of the head and everything. So all signs are they managed to get it all right. The baby did make it to 31 weeks. So it was still preemie. It still had to stay in the hospital for several months, stay on a ventilator to help it breathe. But it is, they report that baby Cassian will be off the ventilator soon. They're trying to wean him off. But he does still have to go under surgery to get rid of this blockage that caused all the problems in the first place.
But all things considered, right.
Amazing.
That's a lot better than the alternative.
Yeah, and it turns out there's a few different types of these fetal surgeries that get done. There's ones where they call open, which was what this is a case of, where they kind of open things up and they do stuff. But then there's like different, they call it fetoscopic. So, you know, like we have keyhole surgeries and they do stuff like that. And they put in shunts and they do other interventions. So it's kind of amazing.
It's one of those things where it's like, I've never considered that this is a thing that we could do. But now that I know that it might be a thing we could do, it feels like there's a lot that
could be done.
With kind of circumventing some of these issues at this specific stage of development, which is hopeful.
Yeah, it is. And it's major respect to the surgeons and these medical teams involved, right? Like, when they delivered baby Cassie in, they had like 30 people around to like just be on ready to like do this exit surgery sort of, in all this sort of stuff. Because, of course, when he was born, like, because he still had this catheter in, they used it to drain what fluid was still there, but then they used it to ventilate him as well for his breathing, because he started breathing himself. And it's just,
love a hopeful medical story. Awesome. Well, moving out of the medical world
to earth sciences,
what's our last topic for today?
So Yellowstone, it's a super volcano. It's basically where Yellowstone is. The Earth's crust is quite thin, or relatively thin to other parts of the planet. And it turns out, I didn't realise this, in the last 2.1 million years, there's been three major eruptions in the area of Yellowstone, the most recent being 631,000 years ago, which created the caldera that it's known for.
Yeah.
What's interesting about Yellowstone is that there's a bit of a debate around the origins of its volcanic activity. So whether it's what's called got a deep mantle plume beneath the surface. So basically, a mantle plume is just super hot material that rises from the Earth's mantle starting at the like core mantle boundary. So it's super hot material that's, you know, heating up the magma that's the volcanic under the crust there for the volcanic activity. The other method that could be leading to its volcanic origins is all about pressures within the crust and the mantle, so tectonic plates, which we well know here in New Zealand. And so this study's just come out that points towards that it's due to tectonic activity. Why we care about this is because it will affect kind of future predictions about what the area will do and what its volcanic activity is.
And typically you want to know if a super volcano is going to do something.
Might be nice, right? So what they did was they basically built a new three-dimensional model where they incorporated past tectonic movements around the Western Northern America, present-day mantle structure, and then data about the lithosphere. So the lithosphere is basically the Earth's hard rocky crust, so the outer bit. And they were basically trying to figure out what's the magma plumbing under Yellowstone, like how's it controlled? And so what they discovered with this modelling is that there's basically two opposing forces pulling at the system. So they have the lithosphere under Yellowstone, so this hard rocky crust. There's actually different densities around this area, and so what this causes is that basically the crust to stretch. So the scientists use the analogy of it's like stretching dough, right? And so it's moving towards the western coast of the US. But then at the same time, you have this older tectonic plate that's sinking below the central eastern North America. So it's sinking below and it's dragging the bottom of the crust downward and it's tilting the volcanic plumbing system. So you've kind of got these two forces that are competing, and so they're kind of pulling the lithosphere apart. And so this is kind of connecting this hot material closer to the surface. And so this is where you get your magma plumbing just below that crust, and so that's where you're kind of getting all this volcanic activity. And what's kind of cool about this as well is that there was a another scientist that wasn't involved in the study had talked about in the thing that I was reading, there'd been this recent study saying that the magma in the area would originate from the southwest of the area in the upper mantle, just below the lithosphere, and then it would migrate to the northeast below the caldera. So they had, I don't know how they worked this out, but they didn't know why, and this model actually kind of explains why this could happen. And so they're basically saying they didn't make any predictions about the future, but they're going, this could help with making predictions in the future. And then they're also saying, like, it could be used to understand other areas and such. And so being a somewhat volcanic country, maybe this has some interest to us. Yeah.
It would be nice to know. We got too many volcanoes to let that slip through our fingers. But anyway, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Find out what the future of fitness looks like at Sports Tech, 23rd and 24th of May, a whole weekend of fun activities focused on the innovative world of sports technology.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.